Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for the nice presentations. I was told not to talk about something really practical. These two ladies will do that. So I'll try to go at a more fundamental level of our concepts of organic matter. First, the key messages. I think it's time to talk about organic matter, and because especially the term soil organic matter or organic matter is really misleading. Should be replaced by organic inputs or organic resources or organic materials on one side and soil organic carbon on the other. Realizing that although soil organic carbon is just part of soil organic matter, but that's what we measure, so we might as well call spade a spade. One thing that I hope it's very clear right now in the literature is that soil organic carbon contents in tropical soils are similar to soils of the temperate region and just as variable. So when you look at this oxisol from Brazil and the smallest soil, I believe, from Iowa, they look very different, but they have actually similar soil organic carbon contents, and certainly they have similar soybean yields nowadays. Then another thing, all this similar organic carbon contents I was talking in the previous slide referred to the topsoil. But now we realize that because of the depth of many soils in the tropics, as well as in the temperate region, that most of the soil organic carbon is in the subsoil. And if you count what we normally measure, let's say up to 0 to 30 centimeters, we have about 200 petagrams of carbon. But if you go to 300 centimeters, it's about four times that much. So about 75% of the soil organic carbon in the tropics are in the subsoil. That means an opportunity. Concentrations are obviously much lower, but the total amount, the quantity, is quite different. Organic inputs, now I'm going to talk about organic inputs first and then about soil organic carbon later. Organic inputs contain all essential nutrients, of course, because it comes from organic areas, but at low concentrations. Animal manures are usually excellent fertilizer because, especially the ruminants, they have very little lignin in their composition. It's been mostly digested by the animal. But non-ruminants like poultry and pig manures contain high level of phosphorus. And if you're adding manure to supply nitrogen to the soil, you may get into a phosphorus eutrophication problem. So this, and with the increased production, especially of poultry, in the tropics, we have to be aware of what that manure contains. At the other end, tropical cattle fed on forest-grown and fertility-depleted soils, low-yielding soils, immobilizes nitrogen instead of mineralizing it. There's ample evidence of that. So not all manures are the same. Unprotected manure volatilizes nitrogen. Manure mixed with sand and soil dilutes its nutrient contents. That's obvious. The best thing is really combining mineral fertilizers with organic inputs. Now, there's a classification now of organic inputs developed by Cheryl Palm and others that really, really helps. So it's put here in the sense of whether your nitrogen content is above or below 2.5% and the lignin content below 15%. And there's a typo in the second one. It should be more. No, it's okay. Okay, so that divides into four classes. One that you can incorporate directly, one that you need to mix with mineral fertilizers or high quality organics, one that you mix with mineral fertilizers or add to compost, and one that you don't want to mix at all, just surface apply it for erosion control and water savings. So I took this one slide before I mentioned it last night, but I must repeat it here. Classes 5 and 6 are animal manures, and the numbers, according to what I've been able to find in the literature, are a little different. But basically, high nitrogen, more than 1.25%. Watch out for phosphorus. And low-quality animal manures that we have a lot in the tropics, again, they can immobilize available nitrogen. Same thing with compost, high quality, just like the leaves, more than 2.5%, less lignin, but also it's well decomposed, no contamination with inorganic materials, cans, plastic bags, wires, and so on. And I mention this because it's very common in the tropics that you have all this stuff there. Or municipal waste that may carry heavy metals from urban compost, and then the low quality compost that are contaminated. So we hope that puts a quantitative framework into the organic inputs. Now let's talk about soil organic carbon, the other side. The definition is organic material that has undergone partial or complete transformation in the soil and is located before the soil surface. You can call it SOM. I prefer SOC, as I mentioned before, because that's what we measure. The structure molecular approach, the long chains of aliphatic and aromatic compounds that have been studied for years, now they're no longer relevant. And I put a couple of references there that allude to that. this authors found that humic acid, fulvic acid, and humin are no longer believed to exist in soils. That they appear to be artifacts of the laboratory extraction procedures. So, of course, they're humic substances and so on when you extract them, and you can call them that, but that's not what the soil apparently has. That was a shock to me, but it fits my biases that rather than the structural molecular approach, you should have a more functional approach. And there came the sensory model of Bill Parton and so on a long time ago, which splits the organic resources of inputs into two, structural or metabolic, and that's very much amplified in the classification I gave before. And then the real soil organic carbon into active, active, slow, and passive pools. These are pools, not fraction. And the idea is to try to get the fractions are something that you quantify, pools are something that you model. So these are pools, but conceptually it really helps us tremendously. So we can divide soil organic carbon in two pools instead of three, and they provide those totally different ecosystem services. The active pool, or labile, it's sometimes called, has a turnover of about 1.5 years, more or less, and it's responsible for the mineralization of nutrients and the energy for soil biota. In other words, they're responsible for soil fertility and as well as the health of the microorganisms. The slow and passive pools, with a turnover time more than 25 years and up to 1,000 years or even beyond that, it's responsible for the cation and anion exchange capacity of organic matter, soil structure in the soil, and for carbon sequestration. So we can unpack, divide easily soil organic carbon into two main pools. Makes life simpler. So you can measure the active organic pools by some methods, such as particular soil organic matter contents, which is which in this experiment from Bernard Malawi was very well correlated with maize nitrogen uptake in sandy soil. So those are the squares. Didn't correlate very well with more clay soils. Well, that's one method. The other one that I'm very excited about is the biologically active carbon soil test developed by Ray Weil. It's a dilute permanganate extractable, and it's called POXC, don't ask me why, and it's an approved method of the soil health methods. The size of this fraction has been found that distinguishes well what farmers call better quality soils in no-till versus conventionally till comparisons. It's basically what the farmers say, it's a good soil. It's no real critical level as such, and that needs work. But apparently topsoils with value lower than 300 milligrams per kilogram of POXE are expected to respond well to manure or compost applications. As I said, this is work in progress, but this is the biologically active, this is the active pool. Now you say, well, how can we measure the slow and passive pool? Don't really know. So the thing to do right now is to measure total soil organic carbon and subtract the active pool. But that's an easy answer now. I think we need to do a better job than that. So slow and passive pools are the main determinants of formation and stabilization of aggregates, which are dependent on texture and clay mineralogy. Sandy topsoils, we know, are unlikely to have much slow or passive soil organic carbon because the soil biota has easy access to the organic inputs with those enormous pores. So unless you flood them, you're not going to build up organic matter in sandy soils. And under normal conditions, I don't think there's a point of expecting a lot of carbon sequestration there, because what's going to come in with the inputs is going to go out CO2 rapidly when the microorganisms get it. But aggregation that happens in clay soils, they protect soil organic carbon from microbial attack. And this happens best when the mineralogy is kaolinitic, oxidic, or allophanic, because it makes it's difficult for microorganisms to penetrate those those coats on the aggregates. So we know now, there's several people, Joe Hansix, the Colorado group, Keith Boston in the audience, that now we have learned that carbon sequestration takes place in soil microaggregates, not the macroaggregates, microaggregates, less than 250 microns, of the slow or passive carbon pools. And until the 90s, soil structure was not given much importance in how the recalcitrant or the stable soil organic carbon pores form and stabilize carbon. Now we know. And here's on the top is the macro aggregates. And then the second one is the micro aggregates. And the dark, not the dark, but the sort of the dark gray sides there are already decomposed organic inputs, and they are really protected by strong layers of oxides and other parts. So this is the double protection, and that's why it's in the microaggregates, not in the macroaggregates. It's even more protected. Now we understand that, and the work of Six and his collaborators, first in Davis and then at ETH Zurich, have really helped that. And, well, let me see. Now, what happens now is we have to realize. I'm not getting my water. Sorry. To realize that there's little relationship left between the original organic inputs, a leaf, a piece of manure, whatever, that was added to the soils, and the fractions now trapped in the slow and passive soil organic carbon pools. And it is the protection, the coatings on that organic carbon that determines the turnover time. You can say, in more layman terms, it's a wrapper, not the candy, that counts as far as carbon sequestration. And there's research done in which you put sugar, the most available organic inputs, And if it's coated by this combination of iron and aluminum oxides and hydroxides mixed with kaolinite clays and soil organic matter, it doesn't go anywhere. So the stronger wrappers, if you wish, are iron and aluminum oxides and hydroxide complexes with one-to-one clays and soil organic carbon. The tropics have a huge carbon sequestration potential, particularly with deep-rooted systems. Why? Because many soils in the tropics have lost much of their topsoil soil organic carbon, and Jenna Rose will address that issue. But when you have deep-rooted crops, meters long, pastures and trees grow fast in the tropics with very deep roots, and those roots will decompose and eventually will form soil organic carbon in a place that is not very, it's not accessible at all by tillage or bioturbation by soil microbiota and so on. So there's probably a lot of this deep soil organic carbon that is unsaturated. This is my view. So I showed this picture yesterday for those who were at the other talk, but it's important because it shows how deep the roots grow. This guy is is not very tall, so you see the accumulation of roots. I hope you can see it clearly in the subsoil as well as in the topsoils, and these are grazed pastures with animals on top. So much of the sequestered carbon is deep in oxisols. The previous pictures from Brazil, this data from the Llanos of Colombia, where one can see at different depths, you see the native savanna, sort of the control, the total amount, total stock of carbons that it had in different rates, and the soil organic carbon stocks 9 years after a combination of graze, brachiaria, humidicola, and legumes for nine years. The numbers are very, very high. And if we look at, they've they've added about 100 tons of carbon per hectare. And sequestration rates numbers are also very high. Why? Because the native savanna, because the Brachiaria dictyonera, or Brachiaria and the legume, adds much more carbon in the root turnover. So this is my slide, last slide, warning. The warning is that carbon sequestration is not forever. because when carbon saturation is reached, it represents an imbalance between photosynthesis and respiration. Photosynthesis has an instantaneous response to increases in atmospheric CO2 that we're experiencing now, while respiration responds to increases in air temperature with a time lag of about 50 years. So it's not forever. Thank you very much.